The Elections Emergency Planning Task Force will come to order for the meeting of October 20th, 2015. Welcome and welcome back, members. Thanks for your time and attention. We finally have a gap of some significance between meetings. If you remember, the first three meetings were bunched pretty closely together. And so this last interim between now and the last meeting has given us at least a little bit of breathing room to think about and digest what we've discussed. Before we go any further, why don't we do as we've done before and go around the table? I think we're at full strength, actually, or almost full strength today. Why don't we go around the table, starting with Ms. Olson from the LCC, and just introduce or reintroduce ourselves to one another.
Hi, I'm Sally Olson with the Legislative Coordinating Commission.
Julie Strother with the Secretary of State's Office.
Kelly Fenton, representative from House District 53B, which is Woodbury.
Michael Nelson, representative from House District 48, which is most of Brooklyn Park.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Joe Kelly. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Specifically, I'm the director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management.
My name is Barrett Lane. I'm the Emergency Management Director for the City of Minneapolis. I'm here representing the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers.
Hi, I'm Taylor Cox. I'm with the Office of Strategic Planning, Minnesota National Guard.
Steve Simons.
Ann Kinner Roth, Deputy State Secretary.
Debbie Erickson, Crow Wing County Auditor Treasurer.
Gary Poser, Director of Elections for the Secretary of State's Office.
Grace Walk Leroy, City of Minneapolis. I'm representing the League of Minnesota Cities.
Mary Kiffmeyer, State Senator.
Lucinda Messman, I'm a Township Clerk representing Minnesota Association of Townships.
My name is Barbara Pru. I'm from the Stillwater School District representing all the school districts.
Katie Sieben from the State Senate.
Thank you all for being here. I think we're expecting possibly one more who said she would come. I'm sure she's on her way. Before we go any further, Mr. Poser, I'm sure you've taken a look at the September 3rd, 2015 meeting minutes. Would you like to move approval of the minutes?
I have, and I will move approval.
Okay. Mr. Poser moves approval. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the meeting minutes of September 3rd, 2015 are approved. Next item on the agenda is just a quick review, or maybe not so quick, of the previous discussions that we've had and sort of a preview of the final meeting. So this is our fourth meeting of six. So we only have two left. And as you recall, the first few meetings were sort of information gathering in large part. And my assessment is that the task force basically looked at, first of all, current Minnesota law addressing elections procedures. And I think we had a good discussion and some good presentations on what that is and, in some cases, what it is not, what guidance is there for us and what guidance absolutely is not there to guide some of you and your offices and your colleagues when it comes to election administration. We also talked about the governor's emergency powers, mostly under Chapter 12, but not only. There are some other powers as well. So we had a good full discussion and some presentations on that. We also talked about Minnesota's approach to emergency planning on a state level, apart from the elections context, what that has meant in the past in other contexts. We then had really two presentations, or arguably two and a half, about what other states have done to prepare for emergencies. And finally, we looked at what authority other states have in case of an emergency impacting an election. And, you know, one thing to remember, and I try to think about this myself, is some of this recent discussion, and one of the main reasons we're here, apart from the fact that Senator Sieben put this in the omnibus bill, I think wisely, is that this is an outgrowth in part about what happened with Hurricane Sandy. And I think it bears mentioning and repeating that in 2012, days before a presidential election, Hurricane Sandy hit with full force the coast of New York and New Jersey, prompting a lot of scrambling in those two states, but prompting after the election a lot of people at the state and national level to ask what guidance, if any, there was in the various states as to how to handle an emergency that hits close to an election. And as I think we've all agreed, we're not likely to have a hurricane anytime soon in Minnesota, but there are weather emergencies, security emergencies, public health emergencies, and other kinds of emergencies. And I think the feeling by many in the legislature, I assume, and Senator Sieben, Senator Kiffmeyer, and Representative Fenton and Representative Nelson can can chime in on this as well, but I think the feeling was that there really was, you know, very little guidance, at least explicit guidance, in terms of what we would do in that kind of situation. So that's really why we've been here, and I think we keep coming back to that theme and that issue, which I assume was the impetus for Senator Sieben's original legislation in the first place. So at the last meeting, we as a task force began a discussion about what approach that we as a group wanted to take regarding both elections emergency plan development and emergency plan procedures. So we had a pretty robust discussion, I would say, about the emergency plan but not the procedures. So if you recall, we divided it into those two spheres. First, what would a plan look like? Some of the questions we asked were things like, okay, who writes or makes such a plan? Is it sort of enforceable? Is it a state plan that everyone has to follow? Is it at the county level? What are the requirements? That sort of thing. And so I think, but we really decided to put on the shelf for later, I think, the discussion about, okay, let's say there's a plan in place. What are the tools available to elections administrators or others to do workarounds, really, in the case of an emergency? What does the toolbox look like? What's in it? What's absolutely not in it? We didn't touch as much on that, and that was intentional, if you recall. We decided to talk about the procedure, really, and the substance, I think, a little further down the road. So I think today's meeting, as I see it, has a couple of goals. First is to review a draft of a proposal for emergency plans based on the discussion from last meeting. And this is a starting place, not necessarily an ending place, but it helps to have something, some central frame of reference that we can all look to, a document that we can tweak or change or do what we want with. And then the second, I think, goal is to begin substantially discussions about recommendations for procedures. So try to get towards a conclusion on the process and on the planning, and then start a full discussion about the procedures. What tools should be available? What shouldn't? What's a good idea, and what's really not such a good idea? So I think the goal for the November meeting, which will be our second-to-last meeting, now we can always schedule more meetings if we want to, but right now we have two that are planned. I think our goal for next time would be to have a draft recommendation, or I guess recommendations, for emergency procedures at that meeting so that we can be prepared to vote on a final recommendation for both the planning and procedures at the December meeting. So to repeat, you'll have a draft in front of you here that you should have received in advance. We'll go over that, take testimony or comment from people about what they like or what they don't like. Hopefully we can, by next meeting, have that pretty much finalized and maybe take a vote on it. Notice we haven't been taking votes on things, and I think that's proper and healthy at this stage. And then hopefully in November be where we are today at this meeting in October on the toolbox piece, so that by December we can wrap that piece up as well. That's kind of how I and in our office we've been thinking about it. So I think we should proceed along those lines, at least for now. Let me just say a word about Senator Kipmeyer.
I was just a little bit, I was looking at ahead of time the plan development options. Are we going to talk about those options, or did I miss something?
Oh, no. I'm just teeing up what the discussion will be. So yes, Senator, my plan was next, after I just say one last bit about procedure here, we'll go and look at some of those plan options, and including the one that is meant as just a starting pack, a starting point in your pack, not an ending point for the starting point. So just a word on format. We've tried to keep this a little less formal than a legislative proceeding, tried to minimize the number of formal votes or motions or things like that, other than, frankly, the meeting minutes. At some point later on, probably not at this meeting, I'm guessing, but maybe so, we'll have to probably, for the record, since this is a legislatively enacted task force, take a vote on some of our final pronouncements. And another thing on format, too, you know, unlike a regular legislative hearing, for those of you more familiar with the process or in the process, if a point is raised as to a particular proposal and no one says anything, that's considered licensed to just full steam ahead. There's a long agenda, a lot of stuff to get to. Chairs don't necessarily encourage discussions on things. If there's no discussion, great, we're headed off to the next agenda item. Not so obviously here. So at this meeting, if necessary, I will, you know, prod or suggest that people maybe weigh in on certain aspects of this. So that's a departure, obviously, from normal legislative procedure. So just fair warning on that. So the next point, Senator Kiffmeyer, I think this is what you were getting to. Item 3 on the agenda. I was hoping that we could review and discuss a possible approach to emergency planning. I say possible because it's a starting point based on the feedback that we got from the last meeting. Not only the last meeting, but probably culminating with the last meeting. That's the most recent, obviously. So if you'd like, I think I can sort of summarize or walk through the draft legislation. You should have it in your packet, and hopefully some of you were able to look at it at the end of last week when it was originally distributed. So I guess the way I would summarize it is this. It's pretty short. It's just front and back of a piece of paper, but my perception of our discussions, and you tell me, anyone can chime in if you think my perception is not an accurate one, but my perception is that the group, for lack of a better phrase, was trying to come up with the sweet spot between total command and control, one size fits all from St. Paul on the one hand, and zero guidance on the other. Not telling elections administrators what to do necessarily, but suggesting for them the key things to consider. And I think if I could, in my own head, as I'm thinking back on that meeting and as I reviewed my notes, we as a group seem to want to get to that place. I'm not saying we all agreed on what that place would be, but we have in mind the same general idea. What's too restrictive or too proscriptive, I guess, and what is what just gives no guidance. So as you'll see in this legislation, it basically requires that there be a state plan focused on emergency procedures for elections, just that there be one. And I think I'm being faithful to our discussions last time when I say I think it's worth noting that this is not rulemaking. This isn't, and some states, if you recall, did do that, like the state of Connecticut, for example, at least in my mind, stands out as a state that was very prescriptive. Everything had the force of law. It was a very detailed, long list of administrative rulemaking that said, these are what the standards are, this is the way it's going to be. This isn't that. So as I'm thinking about what the group seemed to land on last time, it was that, yeah, there ought to be a plan that's focused on state emergency proceedings. It doesn't have legal force, but it's a plan. It's a document that talks about what to do. The next aspect, at least as I see it, is that, as you can see in the text, it requires that the Office of Secretary of State work with the governor on integrating the office into the state, a continuity of government and continuity of operation plans. As we touched on last time, our office of Secretary of State and all the constitutional offices are in this strange space where when the governor, as he has already done, issues executive orders affecting the executive branch, we are not, formally speaking, part of that because we're an independently elected constitutional officer. We're not, a commissioner of a certain department. And so we're not formally within that scope. The idea here in this legislation would be to make sure that there's consultation so that we are sort of woven into that plan. So that's sort of the next point. After that, and this is all focusing on Section 1, I would say, of the legislation before you or the proposed legislation, it requires the state to create, or our office really, to create a guide to assist the counties in creating their own plans, and it says that our office will come up with a model plan or a template, I guess, for counties to use as a starting point for their own planning. So not saying this is what your plan has to look like, but giving them a guide, a resource, something they can cut and paste, make their own, delete, add, whatever, but at least a starting point. And just as one editorial comment of mine, since our last meeting, I've been on the road, and I've been meeting with elections administrators in several counties, particularly in greater Minnesota, smaller counties, and they really crave the template idea. Often these are staffs, if I can generalize, where they wear many hats. They're often auditor treasurers. They often do property taxes. They often are recorder of deeds. They do other things. And so elections is not the only thing that they're focused on. And they really don't have the staff, certainly the people power, to be doing something from scratch in every instance. And so what I got from counties, Kennebec, Isanti, Lake, Redwood, Lincoln, Yellow Medicine, Lac La Parle, and others, was that they liked the template idea. Not saying this has got to be your plan, but here's an example of what your plan might look like. cut, paste, disregard, add, whatever. At least that's the feedback I got. So that's Section 1. Section 2, again, just walking through this legislation, focuses on the county and local emergency planning. It requires county election officials to work with their municipalities and schools to create an emergency plan with a few enumerated contingencies that the plan has to address. And this would seem to allow towns, cities, and schools to have input in the plan without requiring that each of those jurisdictions create their own plan. The school district doesn't have to have one. Not every township has to have one, et cetera, but they should be consulted. So that's the idea there. It also requires that the county plan consider and address voters with disabilities in all aspects of the plan, and we'll hear a little bit about that later. It requires that the plan address ballot security explicitly. It requires that the plan address specific procedures in the instance of polling place relocation. And it requires that the county work across county lines when a jurisdiction within the county crosses county lines. And that happens, as you can well imagine, and many of you know, all over the state. So the idea here is to provide uniformity to those schools and cities that cross county lines, which is a difficult problem in elections administration often. This Section 2 also allows jurisdictions to create their own governing plan so long as it meets the requirements of the county plan. So these local jurisdictions, if they wanted to, could do one, but they're not required to. It might bring them peace of mind to do so if they or their leaders or their voters want them to, but they don't have to. It's not mandatory. And then finally, in summary, the legislation requires that counties and local jurisdictions with their own plan file the plan with the Office of Secretary of State and make any updates by July 1st. And if you recall, last time we had a discussion, or maybe it was the time before, about what the level of oversight should be, should there be any filing requirement for with the Office of Secretary of State, the consensus seemed to be yes, if for no other reason than another physical copy exists in case of a real calamity, like an explosion or something that destroys the tangible or electronic copies of the actual plan. But if you recall, there was a nuanced discussion at one of the meetings, it might have been the one before last, about, okay, is it just filing or is it filing an approval? And I think the consensus, including from me, frankly, was I don't think there's any need for approval or sort of a thumbs up or thumbs down, just simply that the counties make it available and have it on file with our office. So that was the nuance there. You'll note here, by the way, for those who know the process, this legislation does not, at least in this draft form, have an effective date. But I should tell you that if this task force recommends this approach or something like it, our office would commit to creating that guideline, that model plan, that template, so to speak, by March of 2016. And the reason for that is, first, it's just good practice, so we're not scrambling by the late spring and early summer to do it. And second, I think, since this contemplates a bill before the legislature, it seems to me it would give legislators peace of mind if we were able to say, by the way, this bill contemplates a template, and here it is. We've already done it. Here's something for you to look at. So legislators aren't just imagining what one would look like. They actually have one before them. So that's our commitment to all of you. If we decide to go with this approach or something like it, we'll have a model plan or a template or a potential cut-and-paste sort of document for counties available by the time of the legislative session on March 8th. So I just wanted to divert for a second because I mentioned that I wanted to talk about voters with disabilities. And I was wondering if, Ms. Krause, if you wanted to just talk about that briefly, about sort of the importance of that issue and why it might be specifically a good idea to consider voters with disabilities in the plan. I know we've worked on those issues before, and that was a nuance I know that's come up in other contexts. Care to comment?
Surely. Thank you. Thank you, Secretary Simon. I wanted to just mention the importance of this particular population, especially the demographics are changing dramatically. Yeah, you have to include the aging baby boomers as part of the potential disability population. And under the age of 65, we're looking at 20% of the population. Over the age of 65, we're clearly looking at well over 50% of the population having a disability as defined by law. And so the numbers are astronomical. And it's critically important that we bring this to bear when we're developing a plan so that we can prepare for that population and the nuances. How do you get the attention of somebody who's deaf or very hard of hearing, or a whole group of seniors who may have arrived at the polling place to vote and suddenly there is some sort of a episode or something happens and you need to get everyone's attention. According to State Services for the Blind, the quickest and the most efficient way to get somebody's attention is to flick the lights, not to go from person to person. And so just little techniques on how to more effectively work with people who might have a disability. And in doing so, I think expedite the emergency response process, because there's just so many things that we need to take into consideration. And so we have a growing population. We have people who are hard of hearing, people who are going deaf, people who have loss of vision, are going blind, people who still want to be part of the process, they still want to vote, they still want to be part of the community activity. And I think the polling place is where a lot of that interaction takes place for people. It's really viewed, I know I've talked to a lot of folks with disabilities about absentee balloting. And they want to be part of the process. That's where they meet up with their neighbors and they talk about issues and they go out for coffee and it's more of a community. So I don't think we're going to see any decline anytime soon of people with disabilities. And thankfully, I think over the next 2 to 3 decades, we're going to see some pretty increased numbers. With that, I think we need to really look at the accessibility. Now, polling places are generally required to be accessible. The only critical element that isn't there is a restroom requirement. And I think if we were needing to shelter in place for any length of time, we would be a little bit hard-pressed to meet the needs of that voting population, although I've been told that some polling places don't even have restrooms. So we're going to be in a real pickle in that regard. So if we would, advise or suggest or recommend somewhere in the plan that to add to our accessibility requirements, we should probably try to include an accessible restroom if restrooms are provided. And I think just create a plan that addresses the needs of a very large and growing population. Is there?
No, I just wanted to note that as drafted, it's a fairly mild reminder, I'd say. If you look at the language on lines 2.4 or 2.5, mm-hmm. it says, in developing the plan, the county must address these issues. It's really a reminder that they need to be consulting and thinking about these issues, but I wouldn't read this as guaranteeing any particular outcome. This is mostly about the process, as I read this language. So that's why it's in there, just as a reminder, as you and others have tried to remind all of us
and
about the importance.
And with that, Secretary Simon, what happens if there is no... what happens if they don't? Is there any recourse? What happens if... I can see providing a lot of guidance in the model plan. And I've even, for those of you who are familiar with emergency preparedness and Homeland Security Department, we've put a toolbox together, a functional needs planning toolkit for emergency planners. And I was talking to Julie earlier about possibly preparing a scaled-down version for each of the counties so that they can look at the different aspects of what should be included in that plan and under various disability groups. But what if they don't? Is there any kind of accountability that can be ensured? Is there any kind of way that the State Council can work with you to possibly, if we get a complaint from a county that they feel that they're not included or that the response was poor or that they might have been overlooked, do we have the authority to look at these plans as well and to determine whether or not they, what is our role and how do we hold the counties and cities accountable so that when these plans are developed, the needs of people with disabilities are included?
Well, Ms. Cross, I would say this. Certainly our office would be willing to work with you and work with the counties and take advantage of that two-way relationship and partner to work on ways to make sure that they're addressing these concerns. But you raise an interesting issue that I don't think we as a group have discussed, which is any review by for that purpose. Perhaps the State Council on Disability or someone else would be reviewing this in some way. I guess we could talk about that as a group at some point. That's another option as well. As I read this language, it's sort of a hard suggestion to counties and others to take into account voters with disabilities. Doesn't necessarily guarantee an outcome, but in fairness, other laws do. As you know, polling places have to be compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act, so there's already kind of legal infrastructure in place, I would say, for those who, as you know as well as anyone, for places that aren't meeting the current requirements and the current standards. So I don't know that we have to create a different layer of redress here other than the informal channels through our office, perhaps some review component. That would be my first thought, but I'm interested in others' thought about that issue, if you have any.
Mr. Chair, there is a complaint process or there is a process for addressing complaints with regard to polling place access and accessibility within whether a voter feels like they were not allowed access or that the polling place didn't meet the federal requirements and state requirements as are in place currently. So there is a review process and a complaint process that's already in statute if that would be applicable, I would assume, in this situation as well.
And thank you, Ms. Erickson. I would assume it would be, too. I think what this piece of the proposed legislation is about is more about the process, that in developing the county elections emergency plan, these issues must be addressed, which seems to counsel those developing it to reach out actively and affirmatively to disability groups or people and voters with disabilities in order to do this. But I would also think, and I would defer to the expertise we have in this room on emergency management, I would imagine that that's sort of a standard practice or protocol anyway, is for whether it's elections or any other context, I would hope at least, that there would be that kind of consultation going on. Is there anyone in that realm who would care to comment about that? Mr. Kelly or Mr. Lane, about what, to the extent to which already in other contexts that consultation is done on disability issues.
Mr. Secretary and members, certainly we address to the extent that we can in all emergency plans, particularly when it comes to alerts and warnings and sheltering mass care, to review the plans to make sure that they meet those requirements of people that have functional and access needs. So we kind of apply that standard across all emergency plans, like I said, with particular emphasis on those things where, depending on your disability, you're going to be more impacted. Again, you have to have the ability to be warned, alerted that there is an emergency, there's a problem, and if we're going to take responsibility for you in a shelter or mass care scenario, that we have to account for the fact that people have disabilities. So it is a industry practice to account for disabilities. And Barrett, I don't know if you have anything.
Mr. Lane, anything to add?
Mr. Secretary and members, I would agree with that. Generally, we're under best practices to engage the, quote, whole community, as FEMA understands and explains that. And part of that whole community has to be, obviously, people with functional and other needs. So, you know, it's a matter of best practices. But most of us are receiving grant money of some sort or another. And, in fact, it's part of the obligation to engage the whole community as part of that process as well. So I would agree with the director. This is baked into it. You know, how it gets implemented in each and individual plan is kind of the responsibility of that jurisdiction ultimately. But I don't think that it's a it wouldn't come as a surprise to anyone doing emergency management planning that you have to do this. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Mr. Secretary, members, and I agree with that. And a lot of what we try to focus on in response planning is our impacts. And the impacts of an event are different for people of different capabilities, if you will. So we have to account for, and I love the way Barrett said that, we have to account for the whole community. So no one in our profession would be surprised by that requirement.
Okay. So what about this? What about the idea of some sort of review? I'm not saying veto, but review by, say, the State Council on Disabilities or someone else. Is that something that is typically or done or seldom done or never done?
Well, what, Mr. Secretary, members, what we do at for county and city of the first class emergency operations plans is we have a compliance tool because the plans have to be peer reviewed, if you will, and they have to be approved by the local jurisdictional body. So we have created a crosswalk tool where here's all the requirements for a compliant plan, and then you go through and you identify to make sure that all those issues, all those things have been addressed in the plan. So could we come up with an evaluation guide to make sure particularly those things that are specified in the proposed legislation to help people evaluate their plans or create a system of peer evaluations? It certainly is doable.
Okay.
And, Mr. Secretary, if I could just
sure.
Add in, I think, and again, I have the each jurisdiction probably handles this differently, but all of us engage our communities and our local expertise to the extent that we're able to access it. And we, for instance, work with our neighborhood community outreach people as well as our internal disability resources. Now, we have more resources than other people do. We can go to those internal sources. But I would believe, and the director can probably give me a better perspective on this, that as part of that whole community planning outfit, local directors are reaching out to the resources they have in their community to address these needs. I would be really surprised, given all of the discussion that's been had at conferences and training and whatnot. I mean, there's specific training on this that you can get at FEMA and through the state, that this is being missed as a topic. Now, again, people may feel that the implementation is more or less good depending on what the plan is, but I don't think this is off anyone's radar screen. So there are resources out there. I'd be surprised to find that people weren't making at least some use of them.
Okay. Senator Gifford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So when I hear, Margo, when you're talking about this, so applying it specifically to a potential emergency plan and a concept of a template. If you review your organization or anybody else at all reviews the template and finds that it meets the requirements and it encompasses that, and if somebody adopts that or those elements, they have to be customized to an individual in some way or another. Mm-hmm. I like that idea of these are the requirements, and if you meet those requirements, because it's so different from War Road down to Winona over to Pipestone and inner city Minneapolis. Those are all very different. But the elements, those requirements. But I think if you have a template that MnSCOD can review, and we don't need legislation for you to do that. The Secretary of State's office can perfectly, within this, accomplish this without legislation. And I know there's the willingness of our Homeland Security or other folks, Minnesota National, to work with us no matter what. But I think the important thing is that you have the advantage of a template, which I think is very practical and helpful. But if that is reviewed by you, and then it is a resource to any county or any jurisdiction that wants to, leave it upon them to ask your help. But the template can be part of that, can be when you get your local one kind of put together, you can run it by us. But I think I get really concerned, because you can tell when we're even talking about this, I can think of all kinds of amendments and all kinds of stuff already, and you're going to get micromanaging on a state level, and that's a concern. And I think those who have the specific knowledge of elections, they're unlike most any other function. It's a very unique thing. But I think the idea of a template is really good, and that conversation that you have in developing that and your opportunity to contribute to suggestions of how can somebody in inner city, how can somebody, and by the way, emergencies being what they are, they tend to be totally unpredictable, so even your best laid plans. However, if you kind of have those elements and those requirements, you can at least be thinking about that ahead of time. I think that process is very constructive. So, but I think the template being reviewed initially can be probably the most one-time helpful. But if you're going to be looking at reviewing, what do we have, 800 cities and 87 counties, I think that becomes a workload that is too heavy for anybody.
Ms. Cross, do you just want to respond to that?
Yes, I just want to say that I, Secretary Simon, Senator, I really do appreciate the idea, and I like the idea of a template. I think that's going to create a lot of consistency throughout the state. The fact that it's not universally used by everyone concerns me, and the fact that they can not comply with any portion of it and still not be held to any level of... I guess my concern is that we're going to have counties who might want to create their own, who might just inadvertently leave people with disabilities out of the mix, out of their plan, and my concern is that there's no way to hold them accountable, and to say, you know, you have to have a plan that at least has these specific elements in it, or it's not considered a viable plan in the state of Minnesota. And I guess if there's no way to do that, I think we might potentially have a problem. And I would really say this is more of a complaint-driven issue than a review issue. If there's a complaint, you know, does the State Council on Disability have the authority to go in and retrieve that particular plan, obtain a copy of it, and review it, just make sure that people with disabilities were part of the plan and included in it.
That's an interesting wrinkle, which is that not necessarily reviewing plans, but if there's a complaint, mm-hmm. having the ability to access it. That's the issue you're bringing up.
Right. I would view this more as a complaint-driven process, okay.
which the current law is very much so in terms of ADA and the other kind of infrastructure there. Ms. Wackler-Rhodes?
I just wanted to make a comment from the election administrative standpoint that having a template and also resources in the actual model plan would be the best way. I really truly believe that all the election administrators want to implement that, and it may be an oversight because of uneducation of not addressing things. So if there are some basics in there, they can make the application. And I also want to reiterate, because you did point out that the point of contact is definitely, in many cases, going to be the election judges. And, you know, the flipping of the lights, et cetera. Those are good tips. And already in the Secretary of State's election judge manual, there is already a section on how to accommodate and serve those with disabilities. So I see it as a complement to what is already existing in administration. So I think it'll be a viable, workable solution to work together on it.
Any other comments on the disability issue before we get to some other issues? Okay. All right. It was good to get some discussion on that point. Let me just go out a little bit further here. And as we look at this proposal here in particular, are there any bigger issues that stand out to folks, either things you'd like to see added or things you'd like to see junked? We're not going to take any vote here today. I think the idea is that any vote would be probably at the next meeting, but this is for your consideration, and I'm interested in your thoughts about the general framework. As you can see, Section 1 is basically what the plan must address, four pretty broad areas, some talk about this is the statewide plan, and that our office, the Secretary of State, has to coordinate with the governor, and that we have to create a guide or a template. And then Subdivision 2 talks about what the counties do and what they would have to address, and obviously the template would embody that. Mr. Kelly?
Mr. Secretary, up in the top, in Subdivision 1, where it talks about how the plan must address the following and then lists those four elements, mm-hmm. Sub 2 there, the state plan for each potential emergency and contingency. Our general approach in emergency management and emergency planning is to deal with all hazards. In other words, we don't have a plan for tornadoes and a plan for floods and a plan for ice storms. We have plans for, again, the impacts of something. So maybe a description of the kinds of, without regard to the actual hazard, but the kinds of impacts it would have. You know, people can't move around, loss of power, loss of telecommunications, those things that would become obstacles to people being able to vote as opposed to why they are why power is out. It doesn't matter if it's a tornado or an ice storm. If power's out, that's going to be a challenge.
I like the way you put that.
It just lightens the planning load and avoids some trying to make sure that all the plans mesh together.
I like the way you put it, impacts, not hazards. Mm-hmm. We could come up with an infinite list of hazards, but it's the impacts that we care about.
I'd like to echo that and reinforce that the two biggest words that I fear are what if. You know, what if there's a fire? What if zombies are landing? What if, and it goes on and the plan gets longer and longer and longer. We have the, each county has an emergency operations plan. Each county has a threat hazards identification. And again, that what if that's suggested by line 1.1, I have some concerns with.
Okay. Well, the impacts, not hazards language that you both touched on here, that makes sense to me, certainly. Any other thoughts on, as long as we're talking about it, this list of four things, over-inclusive, under-inclusive, generally speaking? Again, we're not going to take any sort of vote this meeting, but this would be the time to bring up any thoughts, problems, suggestions. Well, if not, then section...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Is this the presumption, then, that we're going to do legislation? I mean, is that... I mean, because we're using this as a discussion point, it sounds like a presumed upon approach, which I don't think we've done.
Right. Senator Kiffmeyer, I would say yes. I think that is the presumption. We can certainly talk about that. You know, it's a legitimate discussion to have whether we even need a bill at all. I think I was hearing in the last couple of meetings that would be probably the best approach, but I'm interested in other points of view here. Do you, Senator Kiffmeyer, does anyone else think that legislation is not needed or is not the best approach?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Kiffmeyer.
That's my point. I think we need to, before you go the legislative route, to say, can you do this without legislation? And if you can, you're going to consume resources shepherding legislation through, testifying, going through all of that process. That takes time, and it takes things. And if you're going to do a template for the legislature to consider anyway, then why not, if you could do that without, well, then it kind of makes moot the point of even doing so. But I just look at precious resources of staff and others to be focused more on actually doing that work and in doing of the plan. My opinion is that you may find through doing it you have sufficient legislation for those kinds of impacts, if you want to call them, or in the process of doing that you may find, you know, we could use this. But then you come to the legislature saying, we know that we need that that additional piece of legislation, but right now you don't, and you have all the authority you need, both locally and here, to do it without legislation. But the biggest, so I'm not convinced that legislation is needed or necessarily even helpful to the process. I would rather see it focused around you and the other supportive agencies and the locals in those jurisdictions to actually coming up with what that might be. And so I just think we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves by actually trying to squeeze this into a legislative approach, whereas I think the actual process of doing that without legislation might point out things and give you freedom to maybe determine if or not there are additional legislative things that you need. But by doing the plan, you can be coming to the legislature. If you can do this without legislation, then just go do it.
First of all, I agree with your presumption generally that not every good idea in life needs a bill. That's for sure. And there are plenty of things worth doing that can be done and done well that don't require legislation. So that is true. And you're also right that the act of doing the template, I think, would be a good thing regardless. I guess my own view, but I'm interested in others too, is, you know, we do have Chapter 12, which we've gotten some good overviews on, which I suppose one could say that Chapter 12 itself wouldn't necessarily be required. The executive branch or others could undertake those responsibilities anyway, or at least a large part of them, without legislation. Then again, as I'm looking at some of these things, probably would, if we want there to be a uniform standard throughout Minnesota, there are two basic ways to do it. One is just to say, here's the state plan, all the counties have to follow this plan. I'm hearing, particularly from counties, they don't necessarily want that command and control St. Paul decision. The other option is the lines 1.20 and 1.21, which is to say, all right, we're not going to tell you what plan to follow, but you got to have one. So at least as I'm interpreting our discussion, there seems to be a developing consensus that the county should have one, as long as they have some guidance. I guess that's where I'm coming from, which is why the presumption of legislation. I guess what I would say is we do want to make it as narrowly tailored as possible so that we're not legislating, but I don't know whether any of the other legislators have any tentative thoughts right now. You may not want to say anything yet, or may just see how this all turns out. But Representative Nelson?
Well, thank you, Secretary Simon. But I guess the question in my mind, where I could see that we would need some legislation, what about that county out there that says, no, I'm not going to do this because there's nothing that says I have to. There's nothing in law that says I have to. And, yeah, it may be a smart idea for me to do this, but I don't want to do it. And as you pointed out earlier, the governor can send down executive orders, but it doesn't apply to the Secretary of State or to the auditor's office because they're separately elected positions, and you really don't have to follow them, even though it's probably in the best interest to do that. So, I mean, that's where I would see legislation being needed to make sure that it's done, not the specific of saying it's got to have all these things, but having having a template out there that this is kind of what we've looked at. You can pick and choose from this and do it how you want, but without something telling them they have to do that from the state. And again, I think that would take legislation. I don't think we could do that by executive order and pass it out, because there's going to be some county out there that some county official is going to say, no, I'm not going to do it. You can't make me. And what do we do then? I guess that's counterpoint to what Senator Giffmeyer is saying, that we can do this without it. Although, I mean, we've talked about here, you're going to have this template ready before the legislative session, which doesn't start till March. So at that point, by that between now and then, we could see whether we do need legislation or not. But at some point, we're going to have something from the state, from the legislature, telling them the counties, we want you to do this.
Any other thoughts, particularly by legislators, but maybe not only? Senator Stephen?
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I think I agree with parts of what Senator Kiffmeyer said, maybe especially for Section 1 of the proposed legislation in our packet. If you can go ahead and do this all, I would just assume you get started on that and get it moving so that it gets done sooner and you don't have to wait for the legislative session, which maybe you already did that.
Oh, yeah.
But the caveat to that, and my question would be, is do you need money to do it? And can you come up with money within your office if you do need money, or is this particular section going to require an appropriation?
I have to say, Ms. Strother, why don't you chime on this? I have my own hunch, but.
Yeah, I don't think when we talked about this, we had contemplated needing an appropriation at our office level to do this work, and we could incorporate it into the work that the office is doing already. I think the office has known that this is something that we've wanted to work on and need to work on. It does take time and staff time, so there would be staff time associated with it, but the thought would be that we could incorporate it into the workload that we're already doing.
So, Senator Stephen, if I'm hearing you correctly, I just want to make sure I'm understanding. You're saying that much of Section 1 might not need to be there, other than that we will create such a template that counties may use, that kind of thing, maybe more letter C starting in 1.15, but the rest of it maybe does not require legislation,
well,
as long as it's what we actually implement in the template.
I think that to go back to what Margo said earlier, is my concern with not having anything put into legislation is what is the legal remedy then if there's a complaint? So to go back to a what-if scenario. What if a county doesn't have an emergency plan set in place and there is a gross violation of a person with disabilities that happens in an emergency situation? It would seem to me that having something in statute that says that counties must have a plan would then be more helpful for that person who maybe suffers an injustice or is, you know, their needs are not taken into consideration and there's an emergency. Maybe council could provide more input onto that, whether it's needed. And again, I like the idea that, just to reiterate what others have said, that we're not specifically putting into statute the plan itself, but just that there needs to be a plan.
Okay. Point well taken. Ms. Wuppert?
Mr. Chair, I just have a really dumb question. The handout that you had presented were possible approaches, and number two talked about recommendations. And I guess before we look at the actual draft, the question I have is what is in statute now that would have to change in order to develop this plan? So I'm not sure how pertinent this draft legislation is if we're proposing a template that's currently against the law now.
Actually, that's a good segue into what I hoped we would take the last hour to discuss,
okay. Which
is that second half of the equation. The first half was just the plan. What generally does it cover, who's doing it, that kind of thing. And the second half, which I had kind of unofficially budgeted roughly the last hour, was to discuss exactly that. What are what are the possible tools that can be used in the plan? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. I really want to, I don't think Representative Nelson was meaning to imply this, but it could be taken that way, that our 87 counties, that somebody will just refuse to have an emergency plan. And I don't think we should presume that somebody will. I think that's kind of not a very positive way to kind of look at it. When I think of working with the 87 counties, they all very much do and recognize these things and respond to it. I think for them, having the template and having the support of MACO organization, you have the Association of Townships, you have the city structures, you have a lot of things. If you offer them something, as a matter of fact, they're more willing to take it on than a mandate that then they tend to push back on and also want you to fund them and do other things like that, whereas the mission itself is quite well within the scope already. But I just wanted to say that I can't think of a single county that would actually say, no, I'm just not going to do this unless you pass a law that mandates I do it. I just thought I wanted to say that for them.
Any other comment on this issue? Because what I think we'll do for next time, and a couple of us discussed this before the meeting, is maybe come back with a couple versions of this particular piece, maybe one that is a little bit shorter and that cuts out some of the things which I've heard today that some folks believe some of the things that don't necessarily need to be in statute. And maybe we'll have a version that's more like this and we can decide on it. And I anticipate as to this piece, we'll take some vote. And one option on the table will also be we don't need to appeal at all. I think we should vote on what we want. But why don't we commit to doing that next time? And having those range of options before you. That will be our second-to-last meeting, so I think it is important that we have some recommendation, even though not everyone will agree, but something that we can settle on. Any last thoughts on this piece that's before us before we move on?
Mr. Chair.
Next. Yes, Mr. Lane.
So I just want to call people's attention to the fact that I, on behalf of AMAM, added a couple suggestions here with respect to the draft for discussion. I don't know if it requires a whole lot of discussion in of itself.
Sorry, Mr. Lane, are you referring to this handout?
That's correct. I'd
forgotten about that. Yeah.
So this is entitled Amendments Draft for Discussion.
Right.
And I just suggested a couple, more than anything else, to raise these issues as far as from an emergency management standpoint. So in under Subdivision 2, I'm basically providing here, and this on the official copy would be at 1.20. That the jurisdictions of local, one of the consultation parties would be the local emergency manager. I think that's a big resource. I think it's going to solve a lot of the problems with respect to integration just bringing that person to the table, whoever that is in that jurisdiction. So I did put that in as a consultation suggestion. And then at the further on down, and this would be at 2.4, but also the highlighted section on the draft that I provided, I'm suggesting that the plan has to be coordinated with the emergency operations plan. This is kind of a, in my mind, more of a site security tactical kind of plan. But if something goes wrong, you're going to want to integrate that behavior with the rest of your emergency management system. And from the emergency manager's standpoint, we don't want two parallel things going on here with parallel escalation systems. We want to make sure this is integrated with what the county is, or the city, whoever adopts this, ultimately has got in place already. So, again, in the spirit of making this less directive and more collaborative, the plan must be coordinated with, is the language I used. The second phrase there is adopted in the same manner of the jurisdiction's essentially emergency operations plan. I have less concern about that particular language. Right now, all this does is direct county officials to develop a plan. And I don't know if anyone is disturbed by the fact that it needs to be implemented, and if so, at what level. This, again, seems to me to be more of a, if it sticks to what's in this proposed legislation, strikes me as more of the SOP type of standard operating procedure type of language that you see at the office level, not necessarily in the emergency operations plan. But it doesn't preclude the fact that people could put a lot more in there and make it more robust. So I don't know. I mean, that's something I wanted to tee up to the group. You know, whom do you want to be responsible for not only the development but also the implementation and operation of the plan? And, you know, I defaulted to, if you're going to make this coordinated with, you know, that you adopt it in the same manner as the EOP. I would note for people that that requires an action by the legislating body, so the county board or the city council. Now, I don't know if that's a big deal. Normally, we would probably handle this as a matter of city of Minneapolis, it's just as part of our regular emergency operations plan and be done with it. But I don't know the politics in other people's jurisdictions as to whether that would be an issue or not. But that's what's implied in there, is that the governing board would sign off on this. That may be overkill.
So, Mr. Lane, so in other words, if, well, not just the practice, but if the law is that if it's a county plan, the county board signs off. If it's a city plan, the city council signs off. You're just saying this would be consistent with that, whatever the current requirement is.
For an emergency operations plan, but that what's not required for plans that live at the department level, if you will. So, I mean, if the local election official simply wants to adopt this as his or her direction to his or her staff and policy for that office, that may simply be sufficient. And it may not need the additional stamp of the governing body. It is obviously more work to have to bring it back through the governing body every time you want to tweak these things, particularly when you're dealing with relatively tactical things. If you try something out and decide that you want the tornado plan to send them to the left and not the right, you don't want to have to keep winding that back through the council every time you want to do that. So in retrospect, I think in my view, it might be sufficient to let it live at the election official level and just... But I think you do need to have language in here somewhere that basically says not only are you going to develop it, but you're going to implement it, just as a matter of practical direction here to staff.
So if in Steele County this were to reside in the office of the county auditor, which runs the election, administers the elections, then there would not be the requirement that the county board sign off on this if it was just limited to that department. Is that your intent in offering this?
As it's currently offered, you would have to take all of that to the board.
Okay.
I don't think that you're going to want to do that in retrospect.
Okay.
But there's nothing that says you can't make this part of your emergency operations plan and deal with it that way, or maybe have more general policy statements. But I think there does have to be an operational, I mean, if you're going to direct them to develop the plan, you should probably direct them to implement it.
Okay. Any other thoughts on that piece? Okay. I don't know that we need a formal vote or anything on this, but you're just offering your commentary on what you offered here.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And, you know, if we have different versions of this, I will probably bring back these concepts again for you so that you can see them in those contexts. And, again, in retrospect, I would probably leave it up to the elections officials' discretion to implement the plan. So, but that, to me, that's more of a election officials' decision. Is that sufficient for your purposes? If so, that's great. If not, you do have the option, of course, putting some additional horsepower behind it by making it a board-level document. I'm just not sure that what's being contemplated here is of the right. This isn't really policy-level stuff. This is tactical stuff.
Okay.
Mr. Secretary?
Yes.
I would agree with Mr. Lane's comments that in most cases this wouldn't be something that would get to the policy level of having board involvement for that particular purpose.
Okay. Okay. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, I think one of the important things that I heard, gentlemen, all three of you kind of address was rather than the what-if scenario kind of functioning maybe, and I think of the first one, loss of power is probably a good example. It doesn't matter whether it's from a tornado or winds or a construction crew cutting a line, whatever it is, you have a loss of power. Do you have some other, or do you have something that you work from that's kind of that would be like that? So, because I looked at the other one, and it's a fire or sounding of an alarm. But I think loss of power is important. But, you know, I really like that. I think that would be very helpful, that if you have a loss of power, whatever the reason. So what... I don't know what else would be like that. I was just wondering if you have a list for something like that that you work off.
We take Mr. Chair, Senator, we take a slightly different approach, and I'll let my colleagues chime into this. Generally, what we do is go through a threat hazard risk assessment process. So we would look through, you know, the catalog of things that might happen and try to generalize about what the impacts might be. If you look in the state hazard mitigation plan, they go through and for just about every conceivable hazard that exists, they look at the history and the examples of it and the impacts and so on and so forth. I think that's in the state mitigation plan, isn't it? Yeah. So, and we do the same thing at the city level. Counties do the same thing. But we try to generalize from that and look at what the threat of the impacts might be. So, you know, we're not particularly concerned that it's an influenza pandemic as we are, you know, sort of a very, very large-scale mass casualty. And we try to get away from, as the director was saying, getting too caught up in the scenarios. Now, the risk of that, at least in my opinion, is that you can also lose track of things that people expect you to know about. Like, you know, you can get so generalized that you forget that you're really planning for winter storms when you know you're going to have winter storms. So there's a balance to that. So, and your local emergency manager has already gone through this whole thing for you. So if you can tap into the way that the county or the city already does this type of hazard threat risk assessment, you're going to save yourself a lot of trouble either working with a list or having to go back and do it all over again, because, you know, the hazards are going to be the same whether you're running elections or if you're running inspections. I mean, the problems are going to be more or less the same. So there is a list in, I believe at one point in time, the I don't know if NFPA 1600, which is the national standard for emergency management organizations, was distributed, but there's a list of, I think, 51 different potential scenarios that you could assess if you wish to. So, I mean, if you're thinking about brainstorming, now we've gone through and looked at those and tried to, but we're not, one of them is tsunamis, one of them is, I mean, some of them are just not relevant. But, you know, toward doing your due diligence, you just say not relevant and you move on. So those lists exist, but I would suggest as an alternative approach to tap into the planning process that already exists and rely on the professionalism of your local emergency manager to supply you with kind of the background factors that you're going to need to address. I would certainly defer to either of my colleagues for anything that would be more intelligent than that.
Mr. Kelly?
Which would be anything.
No.
I think I agree with most of what I think Barrett said. But I think what would be instructive and what would make the because he's right, there are a lot of planners out there that are used to looking at these types of things, but we always need the expertise of whoever whatever the function is. In other words, what if I were to facilitate a discussion and be like, what things are going to keep you from being able to hold an election? No power, mm-hmm. Building isn't available, the roads, I can't get anybody there, staff can't be there. You know, those kinds of things I think help guide to probably at the local level the decision to say we got a problem and we have to do something with our election and or what do we have to plan for. So we need the local election officials to tell us what puts you out of business. And then we can do some planning and identifying around that. But the dumbing down of what Mr. Lane said.
That's very well said. That is very well said. What would keep you from functioning and go from that point of view? I think that's very insightful. Thank you.
I think I'd be remiss as an exercise guy if I didn't take the opportunity to say it's not a plan unless it can be tested and exercised. And so somewhere in the planning we need to have a component, whether it's mandated or however that's done, that we need to test the plan to make sure it works.
Mr. Secretary?
Yes.
I think two things is, from my head as an administrator of an election, it's great to define what the issue might be that would cause an emergency to be declared. The thing I'm going to be more concerned about, because somebody else is probably going to tell me that there is a problem or there is an emergency, or as you've stated, there's county plans and city local plans that already decide what is an emergency. From an administrative standpoint, my biggest concern is what am I going to do if there's an emergency? And that's what the template needs to cover for the locals, for the administrators is, okay, somebody, there's an emergency of some kind, what are you going to do about it? And that's the piece that I think that the locals are going to look for guidance on much more so than having a specific definition of what meets an emergency.
Yes, and that's where I'd like to go next for our remaining time. Mr. Lane?
Okay.
I'd like to then pivot to the handout you have in your packet, which we touched on last time, but really didn't go into any depth on, which is emergency elections procedures. Now, in thinking about this, it seems that there are three major possible approaches. One is just say no change, that we would operate under the current election procedures regardless of the emergency. There are no particular maybe shortcuts or accommodations that we would add in case of emergency. We would just go with the existing things that we have. For example, the ability to move a polling place, which already exists right now under current state law. So we could decide that, look, someone declares an emergency, doesn't matter who, we've got the tools right now to make the election go on. Option three, I'm going to skip ahead to three, is that we recommend that our office have rulemaking authority to create special emergency procedures. Put it on there because it's kind of an intellectually honest approach. It's not one I favor. I don't think that our office needs to be making rules with the force of law. But I put it on there because, you know, it's a legitimate topic that some might embrace. Two is the kind of thing that we touched on, the second category. Category two is the kind of thing that we at least alluded to last time, which are there specific, you can call them initiatives, reforms, shortcuts, et cetera, that we want to say can be in the toolbox, can be used only in emergency situations. And here are the examples. One possible example is postponement of the election. I'm not saying I favor that. I personally don't, but that is a legitimate example of one that we could say if we wanted to as a group, that somebody somewhere has the authority to say it's not happening on Tuesday, it's happening a week on Tuesday from Tuesday. Item B would be something like extension of the absentee ballot deadlines. Several states already do this for their normal, regular elections where they have the rule that absentee ballots have to be postmarked by election day, not arrive by election day. That's the minority of states. We're in the majority that says that it has to arrive by election day, not postmark, but we could decide, for example, that that's one. Another one is alternative methods for absentee ballot acceptance. We could say that in times of emergency and only in times of an emergency, you can return your absentee ballot by fax or by email, for example. We don't have that now, but we could use that as a tool. Another one would be to allow out-of-jurisdiction voting. This could take the form of a state write-in ballot, or it could mean somehow that if in a particular county there just isn't any place because of a public health outbreak, for example, to vote, that the voting can actually physically take place in some other jurisdiction. That's another possible tool. E would be consolidation of polling places. This is current law right now with an asterisk. We have this in law. You can consolidate polling places for a lot of reasons, including just convenience, cost savings, which that process takes place usually in the spring, and you have to have that way months in advance. We don't have a process in state law that says on a moment's notice, basically, that you can consolidate. So we might want to consider that as a tool. We could allow expansion of voters eligible for the UOCAVA procedures. Mr. Rother, I'm going to kick this over to you. We discussed this before the meeting. Could you just give a quick tutorial on what that means?
Yeah. For those who don't know, the UOCAVA procedures are for military and overseas voters. And the sort of two big differences, it's like voting absentee. You apply for the ballot, the UOCAVA ballot, but you're allowed to receive it by email. And so you get all of the documents that you need then by email, including the ballot. The law does require for military and overseas voters that they print it out and return the materials by mail. The other sort of shortcut that's allowed for UOCAVA voters is that they don't need a witness signature. They still have to sign it themselves under oath, but they don't require a witness. But the big advantage, I think, in the case of emergencies would be the ability to send the ballot to someone through email as opposed to relying on the Postal Service in the case of an emergency.
Right. Thank you. So, in other words, that letter F is a tool we could decide, and this is a non-exhaustive, non-exclusive list. These are just ones that we thought of in preparing this. And then the final one, and I'll call on you in a second, Representative Nelson, the final one, at least on this list, would be allowing for the increase in polling place hours. So, as an example, giving someone the discretion, be it the local elections administrator or someone, to say, well, you know what, the SWAT team surrounded the building for 2 hours because there was a bomb threat called in. So instead of the polls closing at 8, they're going to close at 10 tonight because that offsets the 2 hours that everyone was displaced. That's one example. So these are the kinds of things, and again, we could decide on number one. We could say, you know, we don't need any of these, or we could decide on some of them and not others. The point is to have a discussion. We don't have a ton of time, but I'm interested in initial thoughts on this list. Well, first of all, do people want approach number one or number three? I shouldn't assume it's two. What do people think about approach one, two, or three? Should we make no changes? Are there specific mechanisms that we should allow in case of an emergency, either on this list or not on this list? Or should we give our office rulemaking authority to just say what the rules are? Any thoughts about which approach is the best? Representative Fenton.
I would like to cross off number three because, like you, I'm not in favor of the rulemaking authority.
Okay. Thank you. I fully agree. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I kind of agree with that, with that number three being, I think that's going too far, as at least right now. The question I had that would we were discussing the UOCAVA voters. I think we talked about this at the last meeting a little bit. Are we going to expand that, include emergency workers who, if there's an statewide emergency or a local emergency, and because of if you're a lineman and you have to go put up power lines across the state because of a big windstorm or a big snowstorm, they would take down a bunch of power lines. Now I'm not able to vote. Are we going to extend that to those type of people? I mean, that's just an example. I mean, that's so that we discussed a little bit of that last time. And again, there's technicalities we're going to have to that would have to be worked out on all that, who we're going to include and what that's going
to
be.
And Representative Nelson, to that particular point, and for those who weren't here at the last meeting, we did discuss that, and that gets into an interesting issue. Someone who maybe doesn't reside in an area where there is an emergency, but because of their job is called to the emergency. They live in Hopkins, Minnesota, and everything's great there. No emergency, but they're called to the emergency, called away from home. And if you recall, this actually happened to Minnesotans in 2012 mm-hmm. who were called to New York and New Jersey, linemen and others, electrical folks, to help out there. And so they were affected by the emergency. They didn't necessarily live in places where the emergency existed. So we could do whatever we wanted as a group. I mean, if there was a consensus or some movement to write something in a statute that would allow for UOCAVA procedures for those folks, we could do anything. But this is the list that I thought would be a good starting point, assuming that number two seems like the right feel. Now, I will say that I'll tee things off myself. I think, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, Senator Kiffmeyer, but I think at one of our meetings, a couple of meetings ago, you and I both shared a real caution about letter A, postponement of elections. unless it's just the absolutely most serious sort of missiles flying situation, I would say, and there's a lot of potential for mischief there. Now, we do have in state law right now the ability right now to postpone March township elections, but that's a little bit different. They're masters of their own destiny, so to speak. It's only that township that's affected. But if a particular township decides to postpone a gubernatorial election, then everyone's got a stake in that, and that becomes a lot more problematic. So that's just my personal preference. I think I would be very wary of explicitly talking about postponements in terms of the toolbox. But are there any reactions people have here, either strongly positive or negative, for this list or ones that you don't see on this list that ought to be either allowed or disallowed in case of an emergency? Senator Siva.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will disagree with you a little bit on letter A, in that I agree that there is the potential for mischief. But just like several years back where we passed legislation related to the vacancy and nomination, so what happens if someone similar to another Senator Wellstone, where there's a very rare situation where there's a plane crash prior to election. And in the end, we came up with a bipartisan solution to craft very specific legislation for that very unlikely event. I think that these are things that Minnesotans would want us to do. If there is a doomsday scenario or something catastrophic happens, it is ridiculous to think that, oh, well, half the state isn't going to get to vote, or half of the voting population isn't going to have access to a ballot, and we'll just have to wait till the next election because of circumstances out of their control. So I think, I don't know if it's specifically this task force that can come to consensus on this in time, but I think that, and when drafting the legislation that got us to this point, I was thinking about, it just seems... that we're not on the forefront or where we should be in planning for emergencies. And we should, it's not for any election. It's for very specific, and I know the devil's in the details, but it's for very specific situations where how do we ensure access to the ballot, which is certainly, and I know everyone in this room agrees, one of the most fundamental rights that we have as citizens. So I think we need to go through this list very carefully and see how can we include all of these? And maybe there are more, you know, some instances where emergencies are more tailored more closely than others. Certainly, like postponement of election day would happen very, very rarely. It might be easier to allow for consolidation of a polling location if one polling place floods, for example. But I would certainly hope that we can get to a place where we're supporting a lot of these things in some method or another, because I think that's what Minnesotans would want and would support.
And Senator Stephen, let me just sort of amend what I was saying about postponement. I think we would have to proceed very carefully. There are arguably some mechanisms in place for a true doomsday scenario in this sense. I know that some of you remember, and I think this came up a couple meetings ago, September 11, 2001 was primary day in the New York mayoral election, the one that ultimately ended up electing Mayor Michael Bloomberg. And there was no ordinance or state legislation on the books, but someone went to court, and a court ordered that the primary election be postponed 2 weeks until September 25th. I think that would exist here in terms of postponement. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know. It's just not clear. But I admit there are some scenarios that we could all think of that are so extreme. I guess the point there, and this is maybe unnecessarily getting into the other questions below, is the more, I want to use the word drastic, I suppose, the remedy, and I think we'd all agree that's a pretty drastic remedy, probably the higher level the decision maker. That's one that we might say, well, only the governor can postpone. And then maybe it's just statewide or nothing. That, you know, Kandy, Ojai County can't necessarily say, for example, we've got bird flu in Wilmer, we're postponing the presidential election for a week. Maybe it would have to be kind of an all or nothing. Either all of Minnesota postpones the presidential election for a week or nobody, and that's the governor's call. Maybe I'm getting ahead of ourselves because that's further down the list. But so I certainly think it's possible. But any other thoughts about these items, pro or con? Senator Giffmeyer.
Yeah, I have real cautions about all of them. I can just imagine the testimony in regards to this. It would be quite controversial, and I think it might detract from, you know, kind of the level of emergency planning that I think we're having a bigger conversation about here. And so I think when I think of any one of these, I think of them. And the other thing is, what constitutes an emergency, that definition, who, without making it, you know, if it's Governor Dayton, a Democrat, or Governor Plenty, a Republican, and they have the sole authority to do something of these things, both in the what constitutes emergency, who, and then this tremendous amount of power vested in one person, I just have real concerns about that. And I think you've given yourself probably one of the best things that we haven't maybe, I think we've been mentioned it, is that you have recourse to the courts. And the court in a whole different situation can have the adversarial and the go together, such as we did with Senator Wellstone. I joined with the Democrats, went together to the Supreme Court hearing and said a certain segment of our absentee ballot law was you had to go in person. It was just something, and it wasn't anticipating this kind of a situation. We joined together. That is, but when you have a court thing, you have transparency, you have openness, you have great opportunity for folks to come. You don't have that with a governor scenario. It's just not set up that way, whereas the court is. And so we just need to remember, and most every time we have an election in one shape or another, the courts are asked to weigh in on something. So they are quite able to do so. So I don't know that vesting it in a person like that is maybe the best solution for something this, plus when I think of the legislative discussion, this is, I think, might detract from your ability to simply do your emergency planning procedural stuff that we've been talking about.
My observation is that some of these are milder and less drastic than others. I think they're not all. I think we'd probably agree that postpone it is up there on the drastic scale. Drastic's not the right word, but, you know, a departure from current practice, I guess. The ones that seem sort of milder to me are things like allowing consolidation of polling places, which, as I mentioned, we do allow now. It's just that you have to do it a few months in advance. So that's one where vesting power in my mind, in my opinion, one person or a limited set of people isn't as problematic as what Senator Kiffmeyer, I think you described with some of the others. Since we already do it, it would just be saying that in case of an emergency, instead of submitting the plan in the spring, you could submit it, you know, within 24 hours. Same with something like allowing for the increase in polling place hours, as long as there were guardrails in place so that someone couldn't indiscriminately do it. But if you know, a SWAT team evacuates a building for 2 hours, it seems fair, and it seems certainly fair to vest in an individual the power to say, you know what, we're going to add 2 hours. There were people who came over their lunch break to vote, and that's exactly when the SWAT team was here. And so we're going to say you can come on back after work and you'll have some extra time. Not mandating it, of course, but vesting in maybe a local official. I don't know. I guess my general thought is the more, and again, drastic has negative connotations. It's the only word I'm coming up with, though. The more, I guess, extreme measures, probably it seems to me we'd want to vest the power with someone of more, I guess, statewide significance, maybe a governor or someone, some statewide office holder, or maybe it's a combination of folks, whereas something like moving a polling place, I'm not so sure that Governor Dayton or Governor whoever needs to weigh in on whether Lacapral County wants to consolidate a polling place on a given day because of a bomb threat. That's my general conception of it, but what are some other thoughts about items on this list? What I'm hearing so far is some saying they should all be considered. There's some sentiment for maybe not doing that in favor of legal recourse in the courts. Is there anyone who thinks there's some mixture, some you'd like to see in the toolkit explicitly and some that you don't favor?
I have one comment. As a township representative, and we have had the power to postpone an election, That's not something any clerk takes lightly. They discuss, first it's discussed with the election judges. It's discussed with their county auditor. This isn't something I keep hearing, well, just one individual. No, it's not one individual who will do it. You're going to consult with people because it is the voting right. You don't want to deny anybody their opportunity to vote. Those who I have not found an actual clerk who's available to who has postponed an election, but from those I've talked to who have spoken with them, it was not a lightly taken decision. I mean, we have instances where township clerks and election judges were stuck at town hall after the election because the storm was so bad, but their population could get in by snowmobile or whatever and vote. So they just stayed there overnight till the next day, and then they went to the county auditor with their vote, with their electronic return, or with their returns because it wasn't electronic. And so it's not, this isn't going to be something anybody takes lightly on the local level.
That's a fair point.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why it's, even though in township elections it's allowed right now, it's very seldom done.
Right.
Even
Even though it's March in Minnesota.
Right. Seldom done. Right. Any other thoughts about this list? And again, there might not be immediate thoughts, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I concur that a lot of the items listed here are valid, but as we've discussed ad nauseum in many of our discussions, that we're always going to forget something, or what if, or this scenario, whatever. So I'm not an expert on crafting legislation, but we could put these down as examples for flexibility and have some type of criteria. What is going to make the best sense for accessibility for the voters? Because there is going to be times where it is the city or town clerk that has to make a decision. Sometimes it's going to be citywide, countywide, and statewide. And so you have so many different scenarios. So we need to craft it very loosely to have the flexibility to respond to the need at that specific emergency, more generic, so to speak.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, you would favor a longer list rather than a shorter list and make it sort of options?
I'm saying what you have here is great, but I don't know if we missed any. So I think we need to have some type of clause or caveat that as long as it meets this criteria of serving the voters, determination of the accessibility for voters to vote, the voters' right, because that ultimately is what we're all here for, that we could flex and expand on this list or modify it as needed, as long as we have a basic criteria of what is considered voter accessibility. That'll cover the voter that has to go to New York for emergency or the voter that's serving their own community for an emergency. It's broader.
Any other thoughts? Let me throw one out there then. Mr. Pope.
Mr. Chair, I agree with Grace about we need to be able to expand the list if the need arises. I guess just thinking of lawsuit wise, my preference is that the law is going to say specifically this is what you will do when if these conditions are met, this is what you will do. Otherwise, we're going to end up in court either way. I mean, if the election official kind of has they can consider this and maybe they want to expand it, then they decide to do it. I think they're going to end up in court because somebody's going to say, well, you weren't required to do that. You're still making a little bit of discretion. And so in some sense, I think the less discretion on the main ones, I think, is what I'd prefer.
Let me throw this out there. And we don't have a ton of time left, and I want to get to some of the items that are towards the bottom of this sheet. Let me throw out what at least I perceive as perhaps the lowest hanging fruit, what to my reading is arguably the least controversial of this list, and that is the consolidation of polling locations. Again, something that we already allow, you just got to do it well in advance. What are everyone's thoughts, if any, about expressly saying, okay, once an emergency is declared, and we haven't gotten yet to the bottom of the sheet about what does that mean and who declares it, but let's just say we've resolved that and one is declared by someone that we've agreed to. What do people think about that being an explicitly mentioned power that can be used by local elections administrator? That is to say, consolidation of polling locations on an emergency basis. I take that only because that one, to my eye and ear, seems to be the least problematic or controversial are the ones on the list. What do people think about that one?
Yes. Mr. Chair, as long as there's a caveat that if there's more than one option, the more accessible option will be selected.
Okay.
Okay.
Any other thoughts on this particular one?
Mr. Stecker, go ahead, Senator. The only thing that I would suggest is that there is some language that talks about consolidation of polling places already in existence in statute with regard to location and distance from one to the next, so that might want to be looked at to make sure that we're not recreating something that would be in conflict with what's already existing for that particular process.
Got it. Okay. Senator Kiffmeyer?
Right. I think that having gone through an amount of, and Senator Stephen, you know what it's been like in our election committee. So even some of these things, again, it's if there is an option that can deal with it other than a caveat of legislation, I think you're better off taking that. I don't know for sure at this time. Again, it's the triggering. What is the emergency? How is that defined? Who makes that decision has as much of an impact as consolidation are the limitations of mileage. Again, the accessibility is a very important part of that. Is that feasible? How far can you have people drive? Those are really big issues, not just, well, we'll just consolidate. There's much more to this than the just the consolidating, as I think Margot brought up, the disability access.
There is. I just think to myself, okay, would an elections administrator, and we have them among us, would they want that as a tool in case of an emergency? Would they want to know that having missed the spring deadline but faced with a public health outbreak, for example, would an election administrator find it useful to know that state law explicitly authorizes them, without running to court, to consolidate polling locations? And then I guess a related, to be fair, question is, well, whether they want it or not, should that be something in statute or left for people to argue that it's necessary in court? I guess that's the question. So I guess the first question is, I guess I'll just ask the elections administrators, would this be useful to have explicitly stated as an option? So you missed the spring deadline, but in October there's a public health outbreak. Would this be useful?
Mr. Secretary, I think it would be a useful tool to have for an election administrator to know that they have that authority to do so.
Okay. Does it matter whether it's in statute or whether a judge tells you can do it?
That depends on when the judge would tell us we could do it. If it was within the deadlines of what would need to be met in order to carry out all the other statutory deadlines that we have in administering the election, then that's fine. If it's something that occurs 2 days, doesn't occur until the day before, we have other logistical issues that have now occurred.
Okay.
Mr. Secretary?
Yes.
I just want to add earlier and refute a little bit about what is said about this. Is I feel that it's the role of the legislature to set state law. And so if we feel like one of these things is important and should be used only in an emergency situation, I don't want to leave it up to the courts to try to read through the lines to decide what should or should not happen. I view the role of the courts as interpreting the laws that the legislature and the governor enact and put into statute. So, you know, and I've made myself clear, I think, before that I would support these things, but I also think it's incumbent on us, as we have a group of experts who work on elections, and I know some of it will be controversial in committee and trying to get these things passed, and maybe it won't be successful, but I think it's better to approach it as what would help election administrators do their jobs, which is allowing people to vote within a designated time frame or whatever other guardrails you want to put in place, and then move on to who decides, who can decide these things, and the other questions we have listed. And because I just think it's not a wise premise to go forth saying, well, we could leave it open to interpretation by the courts, because the courts
rely on Minnesota statute to interpret the law.
I guess the other thing I would say about a courts only approach from my standpoint, and I agree with you, is this: we're talking about a situation in the middle of a disaster where people probably operating on very little or no sleep are having to make judgment calls and very tight timetable. And I would think the last thing they or their county attorneys want to do is say, wow, you know, consolidation of polling places would really help us. We've got to brief this issue before a court and request an emergency hearing to go in so that we can do this. Now, that might not be the case for all of this stuff, but for this particular example, my own personal view is that that seems one that makes sense to put in statute. Any other thoughts?
Mr. Secretary, if I could just say, I think also for the voters' part, I think for the administrators, not just their own ease of administration, they need to be able to tell the voters what is going to happen. And if we're saying, well, we're first going to go to court and there's going to be a decision made in 2 or 3 days, that's like 3 days of where you can't be telling the voters what's going to happen and what the remedy is and where they can go to vote. And we can put on our websites and the polling place finder and all of those things. So to me, the more cut and dried it is that we can do this and that immediately we can start to get that information out, I think that's important for the voters.
Okay. What I'd like to do, and, you know, this is great conversation, time's flying, I'd like to just put that part on the shelf for now and towards the bottom half of the sheet, because these are important questions as well, which is who decides when an emergency occurs that trigger the use of any special procedures. And again, we might decide we don't want any special procedures, but assuming for a moment that one or more of those items are things we do want to be allowed as emergency procedures, who decides? And to add another layer of complexity on it, but one I think we have to address, is that may have to be calibrated to the severity or seriousness of the remedy. And I alluded to this earlier. Take postponement. I think we all agree that, you know, that's a pretty serious remedy. That might be one where we say, well, that's only something a governor, or maybe it's our office or someone else. It doesn't have to be our office. I'm just saying someone decides, whereas some of these others are maybe more appropriate at the local level. So it might not be as simple as saying the governor always or the governor never. There's some nuance required, and probably more nuance than we can fit into 15 or 20 minutes, unfortunately. But I just wanted to touch on these issues, and they are related. So who decides when an emergency occurs? We've gotten some good briefings about what Chapter 12 right now says about current emergencies. The question is, do we piggyback on that? And if the governor declares an emergency for one purpose, can we say that that includes elections? So if there is a public health outbreak, a serious public health outbreak in a particular county or part of the state, and the governor declares an emergency for other purposes, commercial, government, others, can we sort of lump, can we and should we lump elections in with that as well? And should we make the emergency, the who decides question tied to the particular procedure, or should we say, I'll just to take an example, the governor declares that an emergency exists and says that the menu is open. The A through G menu, let's say, I'm just giving it as an example, is open for everyone to decide, or does the governor, to use this particular example or hypothetical, say, I'm declaring emergency and I'm saying you can use A, C, and G? Or is it all or nothing? Is it menu open or closed? Or is it even not the governor? I mean, these are the issues that we have to think through. We have precious little time, but any thoughts? It's a sweepingly broad question, but any thoughts on that and how those interact? Representative Fenton?
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I would say that some emergencies will happen at the local level, and some of us back here in St. Paul may not know that.
Right.
So we need to keep that, and we need to consider that when deciding this.
Right. If in a particular small town there's a bomb threat called in, I'm not sure that the governor of the state of Minnesota needs to be the decision maker there. Then again, if it's a massive public health outbreak, maybe that person, the governor, does need to be the decision maker, and maybe there needs to be some nuance there. Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, and I kind of agree with what Representative Fenton said. I'm thinking of the October 31st snowstorm that happened. If that had been on an election day, now that didn't immobilize the whole state, but it immobilized great portions of it. And so I guess, do you want the governor declaring that for the whole state or just for the counties that it affects? on something like that, or a bomb threat, or any other type of natural disaster, and who's going to do that? I mean, if it's just Hennepin County that's affected, do we have Hennepin County deal with it, or if it's just a certain township that they can already do? I mean, it's a lot more nuanced to this than just saying one or the other. I think we're finding that as we look through this. If you look at the what if scenarios, how are we going to deal with that? Because it may not cover the whole state. It may just be particular counties or even a particular polling place. And at what level of, you know, if it's a particular polling place, moving the polling place probably makes sense. You're not going to postpone an election because one polling place can't vote. So, I mean, there's going to be a lot of nuance, and I think the people here that do elections understand that. I mean, they look at these things, what am I going to do? They're planning for it all the way along.
Okay. Any other thoughts? Go ahead.
In listening, thank you. In listening to the conversation, what keeps crossing my mind is working in a school district with the safety of students, we have three levels, basically, if you will, of an emergency response team. We have a building level, a district level, and then the superintendent level. And in just scratching my notes while listening to the conversation, I'd be interested in hearing what the other election officials would think about leveling that somewhat, where a governor who also does declare snow emergencies in the state could also postpone election. But sometimes when you're on that emergency response team, you kind of just go with the emergency when it happens with practicality. So sometimes being too prescriptive doesn't always work. And I'd be curious to know what others thought about that list.
And there's the tension, I think, that you're outlining too, which is that what's the check on someone either underreacting or overreacting?
Right.
So something that for the rest of us might look like a few snowflakes might strike one person as an emergency. And do we want to vest power in that one person, or maybe a shared power? Maybe it's, I think, some of us talked before, I think it was one of these meetings, it's like the nuclear key codes. Two people have to turn the key or something like that. Maybe it's vested in the governor and someone else, or I don't know. That's one possibility in terms of who has the authority there. And we could put in whatever we wanted, or the legislature could, in terms of sort of guardrails or language about how it has to be reasonable or something like that. So someone who doesn't think it's reasonable to start using these emergency tools in the case of a few snowflakes can stop that, I suppose. So that's one other idea there. So
I have a question. And I just was looking for something through the materials that I had here, because when you have a federal office on the ballot, there are certain federal requirements that a state cannot change, such as the election day.
Right.
And so it's not just a state. And almost every 2 years, we do have a federal office on the ballot, whether it's president, because you have Congress every 2 years, so you always have something on it. And so I think some of these things are limited by some of those federal things as well.
Any other thoughts about this who decides question, and who decides what an emergency and who decides what tool? And is it discretionary? Go ahead.
I just want to agree with the last two comments. I was going to say the same thing. We really have to look at what's on the ballot to determine the level of authority on any of these emergencies. If there is federal offices, we may have to have a different level of authority of implementing an emergency. If it's an odd year election and it's just municipal, it should be up to the municipality. So we also have to consider what's on the ballot, and that will determine the authority of who makes the decision.
And you bring up an interesting point, and I might have added to this sheet, both under other questions 1 and 2, you could add an E that would say something like, you know, the official generally tasked with declaring the emergency, you know, that matches up with the highest level of government running the election. In other words, one easier question is, okay, if it's a city of Minneapolis election, than the city of Minneapolis, doesn't affect anyone outside of Minneapolis, then they maybe can decide.
Right.
Or if it's a county election, only in one county. If Candy-Ohi County is having a special election for commissioners or something like that, then they get to decide. Where it gets trickier is in the, as Senator Kiffmeyer rightly points out, in the even-numbered elections, particularly where there's a federal component. Then it gets tricky.
Right.
Then maybe individual municipalities don't have the authority to do those kinds of things. But I think, I would imagine we could agree that when it's municipal only, or school district only, or county only, that's probably an easier call.
Right.
And maybe that's just something that we can agree on. So any other thoughts about who decides when it occurs and once it occurs and it is decided, who decides what procedures are appropriate for the situation? Let me talk about that second question and just tease out that. Regardless of what you may agree on which tools, if any, ought to be on the list for emergency use only, do you believe it should be sort of black and white? In other words, whoever's making the decision says you get to use the list or not, or does that person have the power to say you get A, D, and E? Or is it just sort of, hey, you're either opening the menu or you're closing the menu and not having that sort of pick-and-choose aspect to it? Does anyone have an opinion on that one way or another?
Mr. Secretary?
Yes.
I have an opinion. Yeah. If we start limiting the list of menu options, if you will, to the person or to a power that be in some way, shape, or form, what criteria and guidelines are you going to put in place that says these are the ones that you can use for different things? I mean, if we're going to have a list, the overarching consideration should be continuity of operations to ensure that voters can cast their ballots at the time and location that they are typically supposed to cast their ballots. That should be the overarching theme of everything we talk about. And that if we start limiting different things, that could impact in ways that we can't consider because we don't know what if. There are too many things that we don't know at this point.
Right. Agreements or disagreements with that?
I'm
hearing a call for these sort of, we decide what, or you know, someone decides what the menu is, and its menu is either open or closed, not vesting in one person the power to say, well, you only get this on the menu or that on the menu. Mr. Poser?
Yeah, my only concern, I guess, with that is then, you know, for a statewide election, some counties might say, so you're saying the counties can, would the counties have to do everything on the list, or would the county then be thinking, well, I think we only have to extend the polling place hours, and I don't think we need to extend the absentees. I'm more worried about the equal protection amongst the rest of the state for everybody if one county just picks and chooses off of this list. So it's one thing if we're saying everything on the list happens in every county versus, you know, somebody just saying, well, this seems to me the one that we need for today's situation.
Mr. Secretary, yes. If I can comment back to that, the only thing I would say to that is, in a circumstance where you're going to have more than one county who's going to be impacted by the same emergency on the exact same day that has crossing jurisdiction issues, there's probably a higher up power that's going to say there's an emergency, these are the things that you're going to have to, this menu is now available for everybody. So,
right, but is the menu available for everybody? Is the menu that everybody has to do everything on the menu? That's where my concern goes.
Which goes to point three at the very bottom of the page, which, as we discussed in other meetings, not to confuse things, but it's a fair point.
Right.
Which is, how do we strike that balance between some rough equality and uniformity and also giving, in many cases, counties the maneuverability and flexibility to do what they need to do in their particular emergency. It may be that there are two adjacent counties. Whatever the disaster emergency is has affected one a lot more than the other, so there are more items on whatever menu is in statute, if it's in statute, that they want to use, and it just doesn't really apply to the other county. But we just don't know. That's the difficulty of this work. Any other thoughts on these two issues? I know it's a lot to discuss, and we don't have a ton of time. It's been a really great discussion, but
all right, yeah.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would say that, Ms. Erickson, that's going to bring us back to our first conversation, that the first type of emergency planning is to continue on the same day, the same time, and as close to all the parameters as the voters have, first and foremost, and that must be it. And I think, even in our conversation, we go beyond that. We already come up with all kinds of scenarios. You can imagine how this could go even more so. So my concern is more, question I have is, what are the current laws? Do we have a list of current laws? I was trying to see if I had it in here. We might have had it in one of our first discussions. The list of current laws that could be used in an emergency. You know, what is that kind of list that we already have that power and that authority? That is more focused usually, though, I think, on a specific polling place. But oftentimes it might affect more than one, but that's okay, because one by one is every polling place and every location is so distinct. But do we have a list like that at all? Did I miss it or didn't save it?
We did at the first meeting, though, if you remember, you probably don't remember it because it's incredibly limited. You know, there's the authority to move a polling place on election day if it's not functional, but it has to be relocated within the precinct or within a certain distance from the precinct.
Okay.
So I can get you that again, another copy, but it is a fairly short and very, the power is not expansive. It's a pretty limited power.
Mr. Chairman, if the focus was just on postponement, I think there are some other moving polling places. There's some others, though, that they do have election judges not showing up. I mean, some of the things that we've talked about. There are other ones. I'd sure like to have a list of them.
I will pass along the list, and that is on the list, that you have the authority to pull someone from the precinct to serve as an election judge.
You found it.
And I will pass this along to you.
Okay, but if we could expand on that, that would be really helpful.
Okay. Mr. Kelly, I thought I saw a hand there.
excuse me, Mr. Secretary. Just a couple of thoughts kind of back to the who gets to decide that an incident, that an event is an emergency or not, to potentially unlock some of these emergency powers and authorities. You know, one of our basic rules is all emergencies, all disasters are local. So usually, generally, the lowest level you can vest that is more appropriate. There's one for local level, local being county and city level, there's only one kind of emergency. So it's called a peacetime emergency. I don't think you probably want to create a special category of emergency, because that's just sort of opening things up a little bit. In a typical emergency, and in accordance with Chapter 12, the city council president or chair or the county board chair is the elected official with the authority to declare a local emergency. And that typically categorically says you can now use some of the emergency, you can use the emergency powers that the jurisdiction has determined get unlocked, if you will, by an emergency declaration. Those local officials don't, they always make those declarations on the recommendation and the advice of the competent official, the sheriff, the fire chief, whomever. And I think that's probably your local elections official to say, we have a problem. We had a fire at the polling place. We, in order to invoke one of these emergency, any of these emergency measures, we need a declaration of an emergency. And then once that emergency is declared, that official then generally turns that back to that responsible official. You know, if it was a typical emergency disaster, a fire, a bus crash on the road, whatever, it would then turn that back to the incident commander, because they're the people who are best qualified to deal with the situation, not the elected official. And again, I think it's those local elections officials who could then figure out, okay, based on our situation here, these are the things, these are the steps that are allowable under emergency situations. And because, you know, we have that authority, we will decide which ones we should do. So the unlocking of those emergency powers is an elected official responsibility, because those are the people ultimately accountable back to the voters in that area. And then it's turned back to the people that have the knowledge and the expertise and the skill to decide how to manage the event. And I don't know if that is instructive as you try to frame this up to try to make that parallel to a more typical, you know, natural disaster or emergency.
Actually, that's really helpful, is to me, to hear you talk about what we talked about at one of our first meetings, which is just that whole category of peacetime emergency, and not sort of creating subcategories of elections peacetime emergency or this other kind of peacetime emergency. So maybe we already have some rough rules of the road in existence, is what I hear
you saying. Yes, sir. And typically the governor will only make the declaration of a state emergency, if you will, and often it's specific to county level, when there is something that is needed from the state. I need a waiver of the hours of work for operating trucks because these power crews are driving all over the state, or I need a waiver of the weight limits because it's springtime, but we got to haul a lot of materials to build dikes and dams to protect. That is a state-level law or regulation. It requires a state-level waiver. So typically the governor will only get involved if the local level needs something. There's some authority that is retained at the state, and as you talked about potentially stratifying your menu items, you know, that could be an example of where a particular rule is retained at a higher level than the local level. But he tends not to say, okay, unless it's necessary, everywhere in the state, it's typically there's an emergency because this and this and this, and therefore I declare that a peacetime emergency exists in these seven counties, as opposed to everywhere in the state, unless, of course, it applied statewide. Okay. So there are just some parallels to the other part of disasters.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. I want to be respectful of everyone's time. We're at the two-hour mark. We started a little late, so we're ending a little bit late. We obviously have our work cut out for us. We have multiple options, though. And I think for our next meeting, and we have two scheduled, we could decide to schedule another one, although I'm wary of subjecting people to more meetings than absolutely necessary. But we could decide, for example, I just want to give you a preview. We could decide, because we do have a report due to the legislature on January 1st, we could decide to be more specific in some areas than others. We could decide, for example, that the model statutory language or some version of it is something that we want to be part of the report, but that for this other part that we spent the last hour discussing, it's more in narrative form. There isn't necessarily a proposed bill or piece of legislation, but rather a description of our deliberations, of our discussions, of the conclusions or consensus we reached, if any. So there are different ways to do this in the report. We need not be uniformly specific or non-specific. We can mix and match, I think. So I think my goal for next time is to have some options for you, and I think we will be probably taking some votes, particularly on the first half of the stuff that we already discussed, to see what the committee this recommendation is. But of course the legislature can do anything it wants. It can ignore what we do, it can swallow it whole, it can do anything in between. This is just a vote on what the recommendation of the overall task force would be. So that's the idea, is next time doing some picking and choosing and refining for simply what goes into our report. Obviously, we're not a legislative body. That's left to the four legislators in this room and their colleagues. But that's the idea next time, is to have some choices and kind of a menu for this group to decide what to do or not to do. And we probably will take some votes and make some at least tentative decisions before our final meeting, which will be in December, at which we will hopefully button everything up and reach some consensus, probably not unanimity, but consensus hopefully. Any other sort of logistical questions or concerns at this point? Okay, thanks for your patience, your time, your great discussion. The meeting is adjourned.